I hope you'll be able to shift with me just a little bit. Another frame of mind, perhaps, for a few minutes tonight. Am I speaking too loudly? Back row? Okay. I can't see the back row, but I assume it's all right. I want to thank the 20-person committee that invited me to be here, and I was particularly appreciative of the courage of the group when I learned that the vote was 11-9. Mike Lundy, my handball pupil, I taught him all he knows, told the committee that he knows me, but he wouldn't vouch for me. Dick Bumpus assured Art Driscoll that you could be a sociologist without being a socialist. That helped, but the thing that really did it was at the last moment I produced a time-worn and faded copy of a printed program from Latham Springs, and W.F. Howard put in a good word for me, so I made it over. Glad to be here. I'm supposed to talk at the large level, and I'm going to do that, but you know, when you're talking about students, when you get down to the basics, you're talking about the individual student and relationships with the individual single student, the boon and bane of our existence. And I understand that some of you have already been on vacations, and this is part of it. So having come directly from the battlefield, I wanted to give you a report from the Lebanon of higher education, Memphis State, that we're winning a few skirmishes, but ignorance is winning more than its share. We're holding on to a few last battlements as best we can and looking for reinforcements. Chancellor M.E. Sadler of Texas Christian University used to speak often to before civic groups, as any university president is wont to do. And inevitably came the question, how many students do you have at TCU? And the usual response was, about 1 in 10. I've often noted that university campuses would be wonderful places to pursue careers if there weren't so many students taking parking places, playing loud music, creating lines, and littering the grounds. But the summer is some respite from this. Actually, school with kids in college and all, it's come down to personal crisis for my wife and me also. And we've just gone through one with the end of the spring semester, a son home from college, a miserable report on grades. Some of you have endured that. You don't like to let your friends know about it. You just say, pray for me, I have a problem. Four F's and a D. Can you believe that? Four F's and a D. I said, son, what in the world is the problem? Four F's and a D. He said, Dad, I guess I just concentrated too much on one course. So, well, let me address some of the trends in higher education at a higher level and away from my personal problems. And the first one of these in the last decades is a shifting enrollments from private to public institutions. In 1950, enrollments were evenly split between private and public schools. Now, 80% are in public schools. Enrollments in private schools have continued to increase so that, in a sense, the private schools have never been as well off as they are today. Comparatively, however, private schools have suffered, and the flow of the students has been to the public community colleges, which accounted for 34% of all enrollments in 1976. Community colleges grew in percentages of enrollments from 14% in 1960 to 34% in 1976, whereas the loss was shared about equally with all the groups in terms of percentage loss. The second trend is transition from free sector to regulated industry. Like most other businesses and industries, education at all levels is becoming increasingly regulated by state and federal agencies. And at the same time, we don't see, that is a general trend, we won't see for several years the full impact of the deregulation that is aborning in Washington now, but we will watch that, and as it proceeds, a counter trend working against this one, we can simply observe how it progresses. Faculty, administrators, and boards of trustees have all lost decision-making autonomy to various agencies and courts. Internal records on students and faculty are controlled. Employment practices are carefully monitored. Building specifications and their maintenance must meet many standards. Campus modifications and services for handicapped students and others have been extensive. And faculty members are learning to teach defensively, just as administrators had already learned to administer defensively. That is, faculty members are learning to deliberately behave in ways that would be defensible in court should they be sued for not adequately or appropriately educating or treating their clients, the students. For example, an accounting major could do well in his coursework and then fail the CPA exam. One possible avenue of recourse for the student would be to sue the college from which he graduated and or the professor for inadequate training. It seems safe to predict that if and as the surplus of lawyers continues to increase, consumer litigation of all kinds will continue to increase. Further, interestingly enough, with the decreased funding for regulatory agencies proposed by the Reagan administration, you can expect sharp increases in legal unemployment. And you know, the Parkinson's law that expands to meet the number of people available to do it. That applies to lawyers too, and with a large surplus of lawyers on the labor market, the only way I know to protect myself in the long run is a suggestion I made to Bill Pinson earlier that we need to encourage the legal malpractice industry as one of the new areas that they might move into. But lawyers are there and they will be occupied. Courts are monitoring the implementation of desegregation of state systems. After a long legal fight, the University of Tennessee at Nashville was court-ordered to become part of Tennessee State University, a black school. States such as North Carolina, Oklahoma, and Maryland have been under tremendous pressure to exclusively place some of their programs in predominantly black universities, such as Morgan State University and North Carolina Central University, as a means of increasing numbers of white students in black schools, and to use other techniques for desegregating both black and white institutions. A third trend is a shift toward public financial support. Since 1930, there's been a major redistribution from private to public funds in support of higher education. From 1929 to 76, combined federal and state support moved from 42 to 63%. Over the same long period, tuition and fees declined from 35% of the income of institutions to 28%. Endowment and private gifts declined from 23% to 8%. Effects of President Reagan's proposals, if enacted, will be to greatly decrease the role of the federal government in the support of higher education, with the states and families taking up the slack for federal funds lost. And I'll call your attention, most of you have picked those, throwaways up. Don't throw them away until you read them. In the hall, I have some sheets on the underfunding, particularly of social science education. I have an interest, vested interest, in funding of social science education. And you'll be impressed by those articles from science. Bless your ministry. So read them, please. A fourth trend is the increasing role of large institutions. The large institution has come to dominate enrollments in higher education. This has been primarily the result of student choice and not intentional public policy. Factors affecting this choice are lower tuition, high academic quality of many public institutions, shift from education for the upper classes to mass education, and shift of population to the South and West, where some of the best institutions have traditionally been state institutions. The shift towards larger institutions has occurred in the private sector also. Small schools have become endangered. Larger size is preferred more often. What was once the curse of bigness has now become the curse of smallness. The growth of enrollments in large universities parallels the growth of large systems of institutions and campuses. In 1978, for example, only 21 of 141 members of the National Association of State Universities and Land-Grant Colleges were still governed by their own individual boards. Only 21 of 141. A fifth factor, trend is changing public confidence. Public confidence in higher education traditionally has been very high. It dropped drastically in the late 60s and early 70s as part of the backlash against student protests and counterculture phenomena of all kinds. Contemporary cynicism regarding many or most institutions and other major aspects of society is the natural fruit of the events of the last 20 years. Assassinations and attempted assassinations of national figures, conduct of a war without the support of a large portion of the citizenry, the counterculture, the flowering and withering of black hopes, abuse of the highest public office in the nation by its occupant, and a growing polarization among people as the national economy falters and inflation rises. Down somewhat now. In a 1979 Harris poll, television news enjoyed the most public confidence, 37% of the respondents, followed by higher ed at 33%. But note that a majority of the people did not express confidence, high confidence, in any institution in society. Public financial support is closely related to public confidence. Higher education is in a relatively good position, but public confidence is tricky and can shift rapidly. President Johnson knew that at the time of his decision to beef up American support of South Vietnamese forces in 1965. The decision received tremendous support from the American people, to which LBJ commented that he was receiving overwhelming support for an underwhelming period of time, which proved to be an accurate prophecy. Another trend, changing intra-institutional priorities and related adjustments. The urgent tasks of the 60s were providing classrooms and teachers and services for the post-World War II baby boom, which hit colleges and universities in full force in the 60s. When evaluating some of the people who were placed in the classrooms in front of students and told that they were teachers, I noted only half facetiously that a biblical approach had been used to find teachers, to wit, go into the highways and byways and compel them to come in. So they went out and gathered as many as they found, both bad and good. One graduate student who had been pressed into emergency service reported to me that he didn't really know what he should be doing, but that he was enjoying immensely reading the text to his students. I have to ask, how many of you at some time had a teacher like that? Oh, okay. So the horror of it all brought you to where you are today, reforming and redeeming the time. Okay, PhD programs sprouted everywhere to prepare faculty members. They began turning out products in large numbers and adjusted to professional styles, which require large numbers of graduate students. That is, graduate students teach many lower-level courses, conduct labs, and assist faculty members with their research. To reduce the number of doctorates produced requires reduction of the number of grad students in the programs, which means that faculty members lose some or most of their best research support. Needless to say, professors are slow to absorb the wisdom of cutting grad programs. As a consequence, many disciplines are producing 2 to 20 times as many doctorates as can be absorbed in higher education, and most graduates prefer to be in higher education. We've reached a steady state in most disciplines, which means that we need replacements for those who are retiring, plus normal attrition to other occupations and pursuits. For example, we need only about 200 PhDs in sociology each year, and we are producing about 800. It seems the only way we'll get a better balance is for students to see the difficulty of finding the kinds of positions they would like to find and decide to go in other directions. The overproduction of PhDs in liberal arts and humanities is forcing these degree holders to find other niches in the labor market. With federal funds available, many schools built buildings they didn't need and sometimes couldn't afford to maintain heat and light. As enrollment growth slowed in the 70s, schools began to settle into their facilities, screen prospective faculty members more carefully, and initiate more stringent criteria in evaluations for tenure promotions and salary increases. Another trend, faculties are getting older. The percentage of older faculty members with tenure keeps rising as the rate of new hiring goes down. The last heavy period of faculty hiring was from 1960 to 70. The next one is supposed to be from 2000 to 2010. The typical age of tenured faculty members in four-year institutions now is 36 to 45. In 2000, it will be 56 to 65. In 2000, there will be far more faculty members 66 years of age and older than 35 and younger. An older faculty is a higher paid faculty, adding to costs, less resilient in adjusting to new curricula and research opportunities, and farther from the age of the students. On the other hand, more faculty members will be strongly committed to their schools because of long years of service. Fewer will be transients just passing through for a few years. This will add to the stability and attention to institutional problems. More faculty members will be obsolete and face the temptation of becoming time servers waiting for retirement. The half-life is a period of time in which, after a person receives their terminal degree, at which they've lost half of their training or half their training is obsolete. The half-life for social science disciplines is about 10 years. And my degree is 17 years old, so I'm walking into the sunset. While the federal government is trying to encourage people to work longer as a major means of keeping the Social Security system solvent, colleges and universities that can afford to do so will be encouraging early retirements in order to bring up-to-date training and fresh ideas into their faculties. Enterprising sorts and wags have suggested a brain depletion allowance modeled after the oil depletion allowances as a means of moving out intellectually depleted faculty members after having provided them a savings program on which they can retire. That's not a bad idea. A defensive stance. The golden age of the 60s was marked by exuberance, expansion, new missions, experimentation, and reform. The contemporary mood is of foreboding doom or of a crippled future, a necessity of leaving no stones unturned in the search for students and money, abandonment of reform, concentrating on contraction and survival and accelerated efforts to serve public needs and improve relations and images with the public and all constituencies. Some signs of all of these are the following. First, the lowering of admissions requirements with skilled efforts to disguise this as its opposite. That is, for example, raising requirements but permitting more exceptions without mentioning the latter. Secondly, the search for non-traditional students who in the past were the least preferred. Third, increased emphasis upon retention of students, sometimes regardless of performance. Next, grade inflation to attract and retain students in courses and departments. A turn toward vocational and professional subjects following student demand. And faculty interest in collective bargaining to protect tenure and real income and sometimes resist the impacts of affirmative action. And finally, search for the following talents in top leadership. Money management, fundraising, student recruiting, with lower emphasis upon innovation and planning. All of these factors have other ramifications. First, it's difficult, if not impossible, to start anything new that doesn't have a market orientation. Will the students buy it? Secondly, support personnel are becoming more important. Recruiters, admission officers, financial aid officers, and student counselors, for example. Top leadership is more cautious and less visible. There's a search for campus consensus before big decisions are made. Strong efforts to avoid controversy. The status quo is more protected. There's more internal tension, more competition between departments and programs, concern and disagreement over who should lose what. In a growth period, to the contrary, there's more generosity between units and less goodwill when the pie is to be divided into smaller pieces. When people can build walls, they tend to do so, and a fortress mentality, individuals and units under siege, tends to take over. And students have changed. They're scoring lower on standardized tests, concentrating more on professional and vocational subjects to the neglect of the arts and sciences. They're less active politically. They're pragmatic and less respectful of rules and regulations. Though less attractive than as students from traditional perspectives, students today have greater influence than ever before. In other years, the church set the agenda for colleges. Then industry and industrial needs had great influence. More recently, professors and their professional guilds had the most influence in shaping fields and a precarious supply of students. Student needs and desires and a precarious supply of students, student needs and desires today have supplemented faculty prerogatives, which I resent, which were dominant in the 60s. This is a period of student hegemony. I love that word. Our system, I don't like the fact of it, but I like the term. Our system is largely driven by enrollments, and this system works best during expansionary periods and less well when enrollments have leveled off as they're now doing. When contraction is occurring, the cost per student goes up as fixed overhead is spread over fewer students and more of the available dollars are committed to attracting and retaining students. Scientists and progressive administrators led institutional development in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. In the 80s and 90s, institutions will reshape themselves in response to the decisions of uncommitted students choosing schools to attend and majors to pursue. Some of the drama of the next two decades will center around the natural and strong efforts of many within the academic community, especially faculty members, to hold on to what they cherish most from the past and the necessity felt more strongly by administrators and trustees to adapt to the new realities of the student market. If the low birth rate declines, as seems to me to be very possible, people are forgetting how to have babies. It's amazing. Student needs and demands and preferences will become ever more powerful factors in the shaping of higher education. In the 60s, the academic revolution consisted of many institutions trying to become research universities and mostly failing. In the 80s and 90s, we will be following the long-time example of community colleges in adjusting to the market. Excellence was the theme. Now it is survival.
I really don't know what the vote of the committee was to invite me, but I'm glad they did. And this is more like a reunion than anything, being able to be with a lot of people I've known for a long time, plus the opportunity to get to know new members of the family. I have looked out over a group of people, many of whom were former students of mine. You're aging. I am grateful, as I indicated this morning, for what those involved in student ministry have meant in my life. Dole Baird was my student director when I was at North Texas State. There is no way to measure the influence of that man's life on my life. W.F. Howard was state director, and in a time when I needed a lot of encouragement, he was there to encourage. You just never know how much good you're doing with a casual comment or an encouragement to people. I'm grateful for what you're doing and the calling God has given you. And although the picture Jerry painted is a rather bleak one, dismal, depressing, dark, I'm thinking about resigning. There will continue to be schools. Yours may not continue to exist. And there will continue to be students. 1 in 10 or however many. Therefore, it is with some concern, obviously, that we look into the 80s and beyond and consider trends in the future in higher education. I want to do a couple of definitions and at least one disclaimer. By higher education, I really mean everything that's post-secondary. because there's no way to look at education in the 80s and 90s and beyond without looking at the whole spectrum. Trade schools, vocational schools, graduate professional schools, colleges, universities, community colleges, the whole thing. It's also important to understand that there is no way to predict the future. In fact, I feel almost unbiblical tackling this topic. The Bible says, you know not what shall be on the morrow. Art Driscoll. And yet, we can peep a little bit into the future and discern something about what is coming, not just for casual curiosity, but because it gives us an opportunity to alter our course, to refashion our direction, to reshape our ministry in order to be more effective as the future intrudes on our present. And that really is all that I'm interested in, is trying to see what ways, by peeping into the immediate future, we can alter to some degree what we're doing in order to do more effectively the significant ministry to which God has called you. Like all good preachers and some bad ones like myself, my sermon is divided into three parts. One, the context of the trends which shape higher education. Two, the impact of those trends on post-secondary education. And third, what all that has to do with the shaping of student ministry for the 80s and perhaps into the 90s. Everybody knows that nothing is shaped or fashioned in a vacuum. It's all a matter of push and tug of the environment and the circumstances which impinge us. And the same thing is true with higher education. All of the factors which are influencing you as an individual are influencing institutions of higher education. Let me just mention them briefly, hitting the high points of what affect us who are involved in higher education, and then take a look at specifically what seems to be the effect and then how that is going to throw itself upon you, causing changes perhaps in regard to student ministry. One of the keys to any view of the future are demographic trends. Jerry has already indicated some of this. I'd like for us to take a world view and then a national view on each one of these. And when you look at the world in regard to demographics, it's clear that the underdeveloped countries are growing far more rapidly population-wise than the developed countries. The developed countries' populations are aging and slowing in growth. The developing countries and the underdeveloped countries' populations are continuing to climb at staggering and discouraging rates. Forecasting for the future continued malnutrition and poverty, hunger and death, disruption and social disintegration. In our own country, that slowing of rate means that there will be a dip in the traditional college-age students. The best forecasts indicate that of the 18-year-olds, there will be anywhere from a 15 to 20% decline. But it doesn't hit everybody the same. The state of Pennsylvania is expecting a 30% decline in their 18-year-olds. Other states, Florida, Texas, California, expecting almost no decline. As the snow belt moves to the sun belt and the migration factors tend to alter the demographic impact. There's also an indication as the population growth slows and ages and traditional college-age students decline in numbers that it will impact us in regard to the makeup of the population and the pressures economically. We cannot ignore some of the things Jerry has indicated because it will affect just about everybody in here before we get through if we don't die too early. A second basic set of trends are economic. The world's economic scene is impossible to predict, much less to describe. But we are all aware of the increasing effort to harbor resources and to stockpile raw materials and to gain exclusive rights through various manipulative efforts toward energy and food supplies. The future economically of the world looks like there will be more multinational companies which are involved less and less in national competition, but rather competition between international companies with little interest for national interest, but only interest for the companies. It means, it looks like, on the world, continuing inflation with no real hope barring total collapse of the world economy because we are so interrelated. Therefore, we look forward, whether we like it or not, either to continued inflation or to devastating depression. It means also on the world and on the national economic front that we can expect continuing industrialization and urbanization in the developing countries, with perhaps a distribution of people in our nation and other developed countries back into the smaller towns, which may say something about colleges and universities in those settings. The economics of the future spell out in big letters the importance of technology and the advance of science. It will more and more be a day of cybernetics, of automation, of computers, of robots, so that the world's industry will turn on technological ability and the capacity to make leapfrog advances in those areas, which highlight the importance still of research, whether it's done by the industry or whether it's done by the university. There are also trends which could be labeled political. In the world, France moves to the left, the United States moves to the right, England blows up. It's difficult to indicate any particular trend in the political scene of the world. There will continue to be conflict between communist and non-communist countries, between totalitarian regimes and so-called democratic regimes. In our country, the picture is a little clearer, as there is an obvious trend to the right politically, a feeling that government ought not be so involved in the shaping of the social milieu, and therefore an effort to pull government back from control. But once an organization grows, it is extremely difficult to slow its growth. And so far, there's not much evidence that the growth of government is being curtailed, and we can expect a continued intrusion of government into various areas of life, including the educational. On the political front, we can expect some reaction to the conservative movement. And if the withdrawal of government from certain programs of social change and economic redistribution are totally annihilated, and the masses of the people who live in the blighted cities, particularly the inner cities, grow hopeless, you will see Liverpool repeated all over this nation within a year. We also can expect in the political sphere in this country an effort to try to define more precisely the relationship between politics and economics, and to some degree a turn to the universities for some help in that. There are also trends which could be labeled social. The breakdown of the family, the devastating problems of our larger cities, particularly in the Northeast and the upper Midwest. Social trends which spell problems in regard to retirement and the aging, with Social Security systems teetering on bankruptcy and older people frightened by inflation rates which seem to erode their hope of the future. It spells social disruption and perhaps chaos, so that social institutions which were counted on to provide stability no longer provide them, affecting all institutions, including education. The obvious crippling of the public schools and the effect that will have upon the whole American concept of democratization is yet to be spelled out. There are trends which could be labeled religious also. In the world, there is a obvious revival of some of the world religions, and there is a expansion of the Christian mission movement. In some places, it out of our comprehension, the revival in Korea, some of the events taking place in parts of Africa and in parts of South America. But for the most part, the world is becoming more secular, more profane, not more religious. Those of us who live in a religious environment and who talk to one another all the time about religious matters begin to think that most of the world thinks that way, and the fact is most of the world doesn't think that way. It's a secular world, it's a technological world, it's an anti or at least indifferent to religion world. In this country, religion, as you know, is having a move toward the right. There's an evidence that people are becoming more personal in their religion and less communal, able in a sense to gain religious experience through television and electronic media rather than in the fellowship of a church. There's more personalism in which individuals judge as an authority rightness or wrongness or religion on the basis of how they feel about it. And that's about it. There's a growing sensualism in religion, where experience becomes a summum bonum. There is an increase in this country in a commercialization of religion in which people make a lot of money off of peddling religious goods and trophies and souvenirs and trips and books and all kinds of stuff. There's also a time of religion in this country in which people are finding that it's easier to turn themselves over to some guru or some authority than it is to work through what we Baptists have always held so dear, and that is the priesthood of the believer and the responsibility of the individual before God. Now, all of these trends, and more that I could mention if we had time, fashion and mold and direct higher education. Let me just indicate some of the ways it's happening, briefly, because Jerry has already painted in broad strokes some of these. You'll find that it will affect the students to whom you minister. For one thing, it'll affect the numbers of the students to whom you may be ministering, because there is likely to be a decline in the numbers of students, particularly the traditional students Jerry mentioned. There is no certainty about what kind of decline, if any. It all depends on how some of the efforts of the schools work out in regard to admissions and recruitment. But one thing you can count on, the schools are not going to let declining enrollments happen without some effort to keep them pumped up. And the pumping up is where your ministry is going to find itself changed. The kinds of students coming your way will increasingly be different. The big upsurge, because that's where the market is and that's therefore where the colleges will go, will tend to be some more in regard to women students. There's more upward possibility there than among men. Furthermore, men are losing interest in college education. Women have not lost interest yet. They seem to be more ambitious, perhaps. There is a tendency for enrollment increases to be far more for women than for men. And just as the population is increasing more rapidly in regard to racial and ethnic minorities, these groups will be increased on your campuses also. You can also expect an increase in the number of commuter students, the number of part-time students, the number of people who are retired who go back to college to find some meaning, and the numbers of people who are in mid-age crisis. Their 40s, or if they have it early in their 30s or late in their 50s, trying to find some new way to put life together and figure that's what college is for, and they come. Parents, grandparents in increasing numbers. There's also the possibility of an upsurge in the numbers of people who have graduated from high school, entered the labor force, somehow become discouraged, perhaps tried a vocational school, and now think they'll try a college, and you can bet the recruiters will be working on them. It's an interesting phenomenon that a couple of decades ago, most people came directly from high school to college. Now an increasing number of people delay at least 3 years, and almost a fourth of entering freshmen will have delayed at least 3 or 4 years. We see it at seminary. It's almost rare to find a student walking straight out of college into a seminary campus. They come via various other avenues. You'll also find that the attitudes of students have been altered. They are going to be more tolerant, apathetic, or more authoritarian and submissive, depending on which of the trends they tend to have followed. They're also going to be career-oriented, unapologetic about study, grades, adequate, not necessarily outstanding, in order to get the job they want. Keep that in mind because it will affect ministry. They're also going to come with different traumas than perhaps some of you have been accustomed to. For students who are married or who are older and married are coming to college with marriage problems. They're coming to school with divorce in their background already. Or divorce is part of the process which propelled them to college in the first place. They're coming with difficulties with their children. Distracted, sidetracked, consumed with concern about their children. Or the mid-age group with their aging parents and what to do with them or about them or to care for them. Now, those are not the typical problems that people in student work used to deal with, but you can count on dealing with it aplenty in the future. It means the traumas of career also will become more important. If you don't really care much about business or believe that the world of work is something that's not very important in life, then not getting a job or knowing what career to get into really doesn't bother you very much. But if you believe it's very important, even if it's an avenue to scratching your hedonistic itch, then you're troubled when it looks like the track on which you found yourself is a dead-end one, or there isn't going to be any job when you get out. And panic can run pretty high in a materialistic, sensate kind of culture. It also has this effect on organization. You'll find more and more colleges are trying to deal with the possibility of declining enrollments. Now, you can do efforts to recruit more students, and therefore you put on more staff, or you can reduce the number of faculty so that you won't be caught with more faculty than you really need. And that causes morale problems that you're going to have to deal with as you minister to faculty, because faculty members will see administrative positions increasing and faculty positions decreasing, and they've got plenty of questions to ask about that, but it's part of the survival syndrome that Jerry indicated. You'll find a struggle to deal with the cost squeeze, which almost every school is in. The index for the cost of higher education has for years run ahead of the consumer price index. This means that every school, unless they are exceptional, are involved in a squeeze in which prices are running far, far away from the increase they're experiencing in regard to income. Now, you don't have many options when that happens to you, and you'll see it happen on your campus. You can either increase income by increasing tuition, which may decrease the numbers of students and therefore cause no net increase, or you can try to raise more money or get more grants or more aid, but that takes more staff and adds more administration, which irritates the faculty. Or you can start cutting back on costs, deferred maintenance. You wondered why the carpet's frayed. Or cutting faculty, freezing salaries, eliminating fringes, moving to part-time faculty. There are all kinds of ways in which it can be done, but the bottom line usually spells decline in quality. A third organizational response is made to the attitude of most of wanting vocational orientation, career. And as Jerry indicated, it's a buyer's market. The students are in command, and therefore schools tend to fashion what they're doing. And at the very time that authoritarianism threatens to undermine the possibilities of continued democracy, schools are moving away from the teaching of students to think critically and analytically and to think only practically. And it may be the insurance the colleges are providing for the demise of Western civilization as we have known it. How does all this affect student ministry? Well, you could tell me better than I could tell you, because you're right there in the trenches and you're experiencing some of these things firsthand. And I have an idea in our sessions this week that you're going to let me know about some of it. And if you feel I've been in an ivory tower and missed the most important, I look forward to hearing from you, because that's the only way I know to learn. I think it's going to have an impact upon you as you relate to the constituency, to the persons to whom you minister. It's going to mean that student ministry is going to have to be more than student ministry. In fact, I'd recommend eliminating that terminology. You are going to have to minister to people who are bound together by the common denominator of being related to higher education. In the days of trauma which are ahead, you won't be able to effectively minister to students unless you and others are ministering to faculty whose morale will be at rock bottom, and to administrators who are seeing their dreams crumble. I had an administrator tell me the other day with a voice cracked with emotion, "It's no fun anymore being in education." You can't minister just to students. You'll minister to administrators, to staff, to faculty, to townspeople, to students, to all of them. You'll minister to faculty who are bewildered by the possibility of loss of a job with not much place to go, with tenure becoming meaningless, with advancement blocked, with mobility paralyzed. You'll deal with faculty who are discovering that they constantly must be retraining, learning how to relate to ethnic and to racial groups and to language groups, how to use telecommunication devices which are foreign to them, how to do extension kinds of things when they'd really rather be cloistered in research, how to be under the gaze of people who are putting them to new tests of evaluation, no longer publish, no longer research, but how well do you draw students? You're going to be dealing with students who are not really affected so much by all that's going around them. They won't know the trauma of the administrator or the agony of the faculty member, but they will experience their own difficulties in the kind of situation we're going to be in the next 10 to 20 years. It will also affect the sort of context in which you do it in regard to attitudes. You'll find that, I think, more and more in the next 5 years, maybe 10, people will have a kind of apathy or super tolerance toward things which will somehow require you to lead them to understand the importance of authority, of relationship, of responsibility. But at the same time, to make it complicated, you'll be dealing with people who have decided that they are going to turn life over to super authority. And for those, you have an opposite tack to take. You must help them to be critical, analytical, and perhaps a little cynical about authority. And that's a tough task, to do both at once. It's going to require also, it seems, an encouragement of people to look beyond the hedonistic or the materialistic or the satisfaction of basic short-range goals, to think in terms of ultimates, of God, of value, of eternity, of love and justice and life beyond a 9-to-5 job and a sailboat on the weekend and a glass of cold beer at night. And then it seems that the trends are going to require those of us, may I include myself, in strategy. Part of it is an international strategy because we live in the world, not just in the United States. And with booming population student-wise in other parts of the world, it will have an impact on us. I think there may be, if our immigration authorities will allow it, a new insurge of students from other places into our colleges and universities, and you can bet our colleges and universities will welcome with open arms if they've got the money to pay when they come. It means also a national strategy. We can no longer afford the luxury of adding new staff members to Bible Belt churches so that they can enjoy one another more, nor the luxury of adding additional staff members to Bible Belt student and faculty campus programs when so much of the country is without adequate program and help. And Southern Baptist, at the agitation, I trust, of those of you who know and care, will understand the urgency of shifting resources from the haves to the have-nots, to the places where there is an abundance of leadership and of money, to places where there is practically neither. And it may take some of you wandering from the promised land to cross back into the desert, to plant your life, as many of you have, in that kind of ministry. But to work on our denomination, to say, if we really believe the gospel is for everybody, then let's take the gospel to every student everywhere. It will also call for a new look at the strategy for local campuses, for local clusterings of students. And I'm not wise enough to know, but some of you are. I'm not intelligent enough nor experienced enough to formulate that, but some of you must. We've got to take some hard looks at the circumstances formulated by the trends of the 80s and 90s. For although there will still be traditional campuses of such size and makeup that the traditional programs will work, the fact is most campuses won't be that. It will be a collection of a hodgepodge of students with practically no homogeneity, calling for people with creativity to determine ways to minister to them. It may mean that we'll have to decide we can't minister to all of them, that there's too many, the commuter, the part-time, the ethnic, the racial, the international, the traditional, it's too wide a variety. And you will focus somehow upon a particular group or cluster of groups and say, we'll do this, but then who will do the other? It may be that there needs to be a new alliance between so-called student ministry and church, in which you become the agitators and the initiators and the trainers, so that the congregations of believers scattered throughout the places where the students are of whatever variety, and the faculty members are of whatever variety, and the trustees are of whatever variety, have the input of your experience and training, so that we all become student ministers with you as the equippers of the ministers. The 80s are different. The 90s probably will be too. Some of you, because of your situation and location, can function much as always. Most of us will not have that luxury. And we had better be ready to be flexible and daring, living beyond our means, so that we come to depend upon Him who has promised us, I'll be with you. Try what must be done. I believe in us. I believe that we will somehow discern the trends, comprehend the impact upon that constituency to which God has called us, and will shape our futures to do what needs to be done to minister to those He has entrusted to us. God bless you.